This is File 38, Cycle 3. Today's date is June 19th, 2018. I am Jean McMillan, and I am interviewing Kenneth Samuel Farwell, Sr., who's going to talk to me about...
Can you erase that one?
No.
It's Kenneth Lewis Farwell, Sr.
Kenneth Lewis Farwell, Sr. All right, I'll get that right. And he's going to talk about his experiences in Korea. In Korea, the ambulance company up on Mount Riga, and anything else that he wants to talk about. But first we'll start with, what is your real name?
My real name is Kenneth Lewis Farwell.
Sorry about that.
Senior.
And what is your birth date?
April 24th, 1931.
And you came to Salisbury as a very young child.
Right.
And you were raised by your grandfather?
Right.
And what was his name?
Lewis Samuel Farwell.
And as a young child, where did you live?
At that time, it was Factory Street in Salisbury, Connecticut.
And what did your grandfather do for a living?
He was supervisor at the Salisbury Cutlery and Handle Company on Factory Street.
And who ran the company?
Phil Warner.
Can you tell me a little bit about Phil Warner?
Wonderful man.
Yep.
Always ready to talk. I used to stop in as a youngster and talk to him, and he would just have candy for us. Every summer he'd take a whole truck. Well, he had an old ancient truck. I don't know what year it was, probably in the 30s. And he'd load it up with us kids and take us up to his camp on Mount Riga.
Oh, my word.
Up on the North Lake.
And he bought houses around the area.
And most of his employees lived in those houses and ended up buying them.
For a very reasonable sum.
Price. Of course, back then it was a lot different than it is today.
Oh, yes. When did you go into the service?
I went into the service in January of 1949.
What part of the service were you in?
U.S. Army.
And what was your rank?
Of course, I went in as a recruit.
Yeah.
A private, and I was corporal when they discharged.
Were you drafted or enlisted?
I enlisted.
What kind of training did you have?
Went through basic training, which was cut short because they were reactivating a 2nd Chemical Mortar Battalion, and they sent most of us from Fort Dix to Army Chemical Center, Maryland, and we trained on the 4.2 mortars, the heavy mortars.
So you were trained in mortar, shells.
Mortar operation,
okay. And you said that there was a group of men that got a lot more pictures in the paper and a lot more publicity.
Well, we always felt that the 1st Cavalry Division and the Marine Corps had a lot more media coverage than
you did.
Maybe that's my opinion again, but I mean, we used to kid them a lot when we get together.
How many years were you in Korea?
I was there 9 months.
Did you see action?
Yes, I did. As much as I ever want to see.
I can imagine. You told me a story about some American prisoners that were trapped.
Well, it was supposedly that the North Koreans had a train loaded with American prisoners heading north. And it was supposed to have been an operation with the 11th Airborne, who was in Korea. They were going to parachute in ahead of the train, cut it off, and then we were going to spearhead up into Munsan, UNSAM, is where it was supposed to happen. And something got mixed up, whether there weren't any prisoners or what happened, I don't know, but the airborne didn't jump, and the offensive one never started, but we kept going. We ended up in Unsan, surrounded by the Koreans for about a day and a half.
Oh, my word.
That's when the 1st Cavalry reached Unsan, a big headline in the Stars and Stripes, and First cavalry reaches Unsaw.
Oh, my
word. We'd already been there a day and a half. But see, we were a small outfit, so we weren't really considered, I guess.
How many were in your outfit?
Oh, God, let me see. We were way under strength. So we had four squadrons, and we had three companies, so 8, 32, 64, probably a couple hundred counting at headquarters. Now, that's in one company. We had
okay.
three companies, A, B, and C.
Mm-hmm. You had another story about hiding in a mud hut.
Right. Well, we call them mud huts. They're Korean homes.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much built out of, well, it's like an adobe place, but and what they have is like a door in the front and maybe a couple of windows in the front and nothing in the rear or the sides.
Ah.
And when the Chinese overran us, of course, we were getting out of there. And we went into this house more or less for cover. You know, you could see the Chinese going up and down the valley. And we were there that night until the next day. We were about a day and a half behind the line. And they never came in the house. And like I told you before, they came with a truck, backed up to the, like a shed at the end of the house, loaded the rice or whatever food was there on the truck, and drove away. I mean, if they had come in, you would have been all over.
But they didn't.
They didn't.
Oh.
And it was almost like somebody was watching over us.
That's good. That's very good.
And then, of course, the artillery was putting a barrage right in front of the house, and the Air Force was hitting the mountain behind it. And what we didn't know was that we sent an old Korean guy with a note in his shoe and asked him to go find the Americans. So he was gone all day. And late in the afternoon, he came back and he told us that the Americans were kilometer, kilometer and a half up the valley. So we just took off. And when we got up there, you could see there was what I call an elevated railroad, you know, how
mm-hmm.
building up. And just the other side, you could see the American tanks over there. What a feeling.
Oh, yeah.
Running away with arms, you know, we don't wonder if we were.
We're Americans!
Yeah.
Oh, my. Now, I understood from you that Phil Warner and Senator McMahon got you out of the country.
McMahon, yeah. My grandfather, of course, he was great friends with Phil.
Mm-hmm.
And this was unbeknown to me, that at that time, McMahon was senator from Connecticut. And he was friends with, well, of course, Phil was a Democrat and
yeah.
friends and so forth. And I was in Korea this one day, and guy from headquarters came along and said, Ken, pack your goods, you're going home. I said, I'm already here. And I said, don't kid me. I said, I want to get out of here, but I, you know, don't make a joke of it. Said, no, you're going home. So then I still sort of doubted it, but then the company commander, Jeep, came up, and the driver, I knew him pretty well. He said, I'm ready to take you back to Korea, Ken, you're going home. I said, you too. He said, no, I'm serious. He said, you're going home. You've got to go home on emergency leave. I couldn't figure out what emergency leave. And then I found out your grandfather was sick.
Ah, then that's why.
And I was home. They had a parade for me and the whole bit.
Oh, good.
And Phil's wife, Millicent Warner, she was selectman then.
What was her name?
Millicent.
Oh, yes.
And she came and said a few words and welcomed me home. They told me later with her, too, since her son went down in a boat in World War II, she had really attended any military operations, but she came. I thought that was nice.
That was very, very nice of her. When you got back home, where did you go to work?
When I first got home from after I discharged, of course, I was stationed at Fort Devens in Camp Drum, New York.
Were you at Fort Devens?
Mm-hmm.
We lived in that area, so I knew Fort Devens well.
Yep. In fact, there's where I went for reassignment.
Oh.
So sat there for 2 weeks. Every morning, go and check if your name was on the list to be assigned, and was in the back and sleep the rest of the day.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
But then finally, they assigned me to the. They had just activated the Tennessee National Guard. But they pretty much filled that outfit up with. I guess they'd been there about a year, and they, of course, released the guard members. Korean veterans to the fallout. That's when we went up to Camp on winter maneuvers. After spending a winter in Korea, they put us in winter maneuvers.
Ooh! That was
but
not.
The difference was we had every piece of the latest winter equipment at Camp Norman.
Oh, okay.
It was a piece of cake, really. In Korea, we just had to park it, and if it wasn't for the down sleeping bag,
oh.
I don't know what would happen.
Good Lord. It's a cold country where you were.
In the North Korea Mountains, very cold.
Very cold.
30 below zero.
Woo! When you got home, where did you work?
A friend of mine was working for a railroad. We were putting stone down from Kent, Cornwall, all the way up to Falls Village. And I went and joined. You know, worked for the railroad. We just put the stone down.
Yep.
Working with Andy, and I think I worked there a couple, 3 months, and then an opening came. The Salt Creek Post Office. The postmaster passed away, and at that time, it was a political position. You know, if the spouse passed away, the other spouse got the job.
Uh huh.
I went to work, I think I worked there like a couple of weeks. And Mrs. Barton, George Barton was the postmaster then. And Mrs. Barton at first said she didn't want the job. And then I guess she changed her mind. And then of course they let me go, she went back in.
Mrs. George Barton? Mrs. George Barton? In Salisbury?
Yeah, Mary.
Okay. Not Mary Barton.
Old Mary.
Old Mary. Yeah, okay. Because I knew the son George that was in the Lakeville post office. Okay.
Dick
Barton? Yeah, Dick Barton. Right. And I had both of their children.
Okay.
So I got a little bit of knowledge.
He did like 25, 30 years in the service and then did the same in the post office.
Yep. 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 He's the only other one that I've interviewed on the Korean War. Yep. What happened after the post office?
Let's see, what did I do then? I went for work for this guy with a soda distributorship. Cot Quality Beverages.
Pardon?
Cot Beverages.
Oh, okay.
C-O-T-T.
Yep. Yep.
And then I went over to Hosen's in Armenia. And he got me through the VA. More or less on-the-job training to be district manager of the soda company, which is a title, but not much of a...
Not much of pay, but a nice title.
Yeah, right. Not much of an advancement.
When did you go into the ambulance?
That's a good question. Whenever it was established, I think I was already in EMT, or maybe that's when I got to be EMT, because like I told you, I want EMT for the racetrack.
Right. Right.
And the two sort of combined.
Well, that would be about the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd say so, yeah. And then I was EMT at the racetrack for practices.
And that would be what, Tuesdays and Fridays?
Tuesdays and Fridays. Sometimes, mostly Tuesdays. I guarantee not a Tuesday. Friday usually was when they had a club event come in. And they were pretty much booked pretty solid with the club events. So you get your ears up there in a truck.
So you really didn't have anything to do, but you were there in case.
That's it, more or less a standby deal. Well, I mean, you know, we was in what they call a wrecker ambulance. So ambulance and wrecker, like if cars would break down, you'd go and bring a tow them in with a truck.
How did you get your training for the EMT?
Well, Sharon's hospital.
And it was Dr. Rayall?
Rayall started it, and all the doctors were involved. Pretty much only one had a week, or one of the weeks they'd have their session. Sometimes it took a couple of weeks, or however they thought it took.
Because you mentioned Dr. Rayall, I called him, and he's going to give me an oral history on training the EMTs for the ambulance. So it's a chain. It's a chain.
So he remembered.
Oh, yes. He did say it was ancient history, but that was all right. And the other gentleman that you said was important was whom?
Reese.
Why?
He's the one. I know in your article there it said that there was a bad accident at Salisbury and you had to wait for the Sharon ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it must have been right in the area of the White Hart. Of course, Reese must have saw it and he had to get a
ambulance.
But Reese really was the president of the ambulance squad and he really got things going. And of course, he had the connections to get aid and so forth. He was really good about it. I would say those two, Rayall and Reese Harris, were really the backbone of the whole beginning.
And the Salisbury Ambulance Corps just took care of the village of Salisbury?
Well, it depended. Of course, they have what they call a mutual aid assistance. You know, like if, let's say if Canaan or Falls Village mm-hmm. or Sharon, Milliken, any of them, had a real serious event, then call an ambulance.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, it was Salisbury with the understanding that they would help if needed.
How did you know to go on a call? Did you have a specific day, or did you just appear?
No, just usually they hear the siren, and then you go on the radio. Of course, the firemen, I was a fireman at that time, too. And they had the radio, what do you call them, telling you where the fire was. Of course, the siren. Of course, I live right in Lakeville, right by the fire.
They moved it. Firehouse is someplace else now, but it was the one that was on Montgomery Street. Then that was the siren, and when the siren went off, you knew that there was something going on.
One day, I never lived through it. I stepped through the siren. I lived halfway up Montgomery Street.
Ooh! Good sleeper.
I worked 311 in graveyard, both jobs, and I used to have the radio in the bedroom, so to filter out the noise of the kids,
Sure.
I could filter out the noise of the sirens.
Oh, Lordy. What kind of training did you have with Sharon Hospital?
Basically everything. I mean, each doctor had their, sometimes there was broken bones, sometimes there was a heart attack, birth, childbirth. I told you one with the Rayall, a lot of times he was a surgeon. He had a film, showing up. A lot of it was film.
Ah, okay.
And one night, we went in. He had the projector set up. And he started the film, and then he left for something. Come back. It was really weird because on the film, it showed the first thing you saw was a white ball. And then pretty soon here comes a black pen and makes a cross on it, or X, whatever you want to call it. The guy comes in with a drill instead of drilling, it's a guy, they're operating on his brain. Just about then, Rayall comes back and whoops, he turned it off. He said, this is a little beyond you guys.
You're not doing brain surgery.
So he put the right thing on.
Oh, goodness. Oop. And I think you said that you didn't start doing intravenous.
No, they started just as I retired to go to Vegas.
And that must have been about 86?
85, 86.
Yeah, 85, 86.
Those dates, I mean, I think they should be. I'm just coinciding.
But, that's fine.
I retired when I went to Vegas.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
So they're in the ballpark.
But they're in the ballpark, and that's really all I need. because that gives you benchmarks, which is what I was looking for. When you were working at Lime Rock, how long did you work at Lime Rock?
17 years. You remember, I had part-time, I suppose, but you know, like Tuesday would be from 1 to 5. And that's when you're practicing. With the Lime Rock Association, the Lime Rock Tract, they never really got along.
I know.
And they had all kinds of restrictions. So the one restriction was they couldn't do anything in the morning and the races hadn't started. Well, they could start at noon to 5. Same thing, no racing on Sunday. They'd have to hold it.
They're still fussing about that one. You had a good story about Paul Newman having an accident. It wasn't a good story, but it was a story about Paul Newman.
Yeah, right. Of course, when Paul really started to learn to drive with Bob Sharp, who came from Wilton, Connecticut. And Bob, I guess, more or less got Paul into racing. And he was practicing one day, and he coming down the straightaway, he lost the brakes on his car. And they were practicing for a Trans Am, I think, with one of John Buffson's English Fords. And when he lost the brake, Paul tried to turn it sideways to sort of help slow it down. But once he got off the end of the straightaway, it's dirt. He started kicking up dirt and he spun around and put the car into against a tree. Luckily, well, I guess it was lucky, or maybe it would have been the other way around if it had been a regular American Ford. But the tree turned came right in through the door where the driver wouldn't have had it normal. So I saw that and sort of gave me a little palpitation with the other guy on the phone. Okay. I got down there and he's outside the car. And I get down and I said, Paul, you okay? And he says, yeah, I'm okay. He says, there's no brakes on that car. And by that time, Bob Sharp comes down and Paul told him too. He says, Bob, there's no brake. You got in the car and he's pumping the brake. No brake.
Oh my.
And then Tommy Sassoni, who was his driving partner, you know, getting ready for the race, he used to fly in a helicopter in a Piper Cub. He used to hide it down at the dump because it was illegal to land a plane in Salisbury. I don't know if I should say that or not, but. And all Paul could think of was that Alex was probably going to hit Tommy's airplane.
Oh dear! But he didn't.
He didn't.
Is there something else that you'd like to tell me about either the ambulance or your working career that I haven't asked you?
Not really. I mean, there was a pretty good operation. You know, you just had the equipment. That's another thing with Lime Rock. They had a couple of the old ambulances, but I would equip them the way the state required for it. In fact, they would come and inspect them and make sure everything was there. And of course, the Salisbury ambulance, they had all the latest equipment. In fact, they even went to get the jaws. They call the jaws of life. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. How many were on the squad when you were there?
Where are
you? At the ambulance.
How many were on that list?
Well, there were about eight or ten.
And then, of course, it started new ones as the classes were...
They would grow.
Even more, yeah. And then some would be even some...
Yeah.
Sort of a rotating situation.
Did you enjoy doing the ambulance and the EMT work?
A couple of times, well, it was very, they were minor, but... In fact, I might see, during the training, you had to... I had to spend 8 hours in the emergency room in Sharon. So, I don't know if you call it good or not,
no.
But I didn't have anybody. We had one kid come in from Hotchkiss Hockey. He was a hockey player. And he got hit with a stick over the eye, with stitches over the eye. So I just was there with the doctor to stitch his eye up. And other than that, we can only just guys walking in. One guy, I guess, walked in and said, oh, he's having a heart attack. And he was.
Oh, goodness.
I see you, but it's just a walk-in thing. Where,
yeah.
You know. Then another kid came in and had a pain in his chest, and he had a pimple. And this doctor, I still laugh about it. He wasn't the cleanest kid in the world. So the doctor took this I suppose it's to help you stick the bandage on, you know, the tape.
Yeah.
He washed his chest.
So it would stick.
He stuck that thing on there. And after the kid met the doctor, well, he says there's going to be one clean spot on the tongue.
Thank you so much, Mr. Farwell. This has been very enjoyable.
The only other thing I told you, too, was about how Dr. Goodnatch, I don't know if we had to go.
Tell me about Dr. Goodnatch.
Well, I was working at Lime Rock for a club event, and these guys used to usually, up to downhill, they roll their car, you know, they understeer or whatever, they roll the car, and the bell helmet would come down and break the collarbone or hit them in the head. So usually the doctor would say, well, just, you know, let's go in and set in the old ambulance house there for a little while so we can observe it. So then we had a guy break his leg, so they're going to send him to the hospital, so the doctor at the racetrack said, well, put these guys in and take them down too, you know, and check them. So when I backed up, the five guys get out. Dr. Goodnatch was on duty, I guess, he comes out. He looks at me and he says, what do you do? Wait till you get a load? That's crazy.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I hope everything.
Oh, it's perfect.